I'm Tom Hall on 88.1. Welcome to Maryland Morning. One in four Baltimore residents lives in a so-called food desert, a place without easy access to healthy, nutritious food. The Reverend Heber Brown, a pastor and activist, is helping to solve that problem. He joins me to talk about the Black Church Food Security Network, which gets good food from local farmers into the hands of city residents. Plus, conversation about how our relationships with our siblings evolve as we get older. Jeffrey Greif and Michael Woolley have written a book about adult brothers and sisters, love and loyalty, complications and consequences. Then Dr. Skip Saunders has just stepped down as the director of the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture. We'll talk about the unique role the museum plays in Baltimore's cultural life. Theater critic J. Wren Russick has a review of the all-female production of Shakespeare's As You Like It at Baltimore's Center Stage. First, the news.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody, on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. So glad you are with us on this Monday morning. You know, Baltimore is home to more than 600,000 people. And while there are many restaurants and grocery stores and food markets across the city, there are also many places where poverty and geography, and some would suggest structural racism, have combined to create so-called food deserts, neighborhoods where it's just not easy for residents to find any fresh, wholesome food. Well, my first guest this morning is the Reverend Dr. Heber Brown. He's the senior pastor at Pleasant Hope Baptist Church in North Baltimore. He decided to address the problem of food deserts by creating the Black Church Food Security Network. His work to bring food from local farmers to city neighborhoods by way of a network of churches has earned Heber Brown numerous accolades, including being named one of the 50 best and brightest people working to save the planet by the online environmental journal Grist. That's just one of the many kudos that he's received for this and some of his other initiatives, which include a residential solar project, an orchard program, and a freedom school that teaches young people about growing and cooking their own food. He is a busy guy, and he's here in the studio. Mm-hmm. Reverend Brown, it's good to see you.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's talk about the Black Church Food Security Network. How does it work?
Yeah, so basically, in a nutshell, we connect farmers with Black churches here in the city and create pipelines for fresh food to go straight from the farm to the sanctuaries. On days when churches normally gather, we'll come, for instance, on their Bible study day or a worship day. And once they conclude their services, we have a pop-up farm stand right there in the church or on the grounds of the church for folks to purchase food from farmers.
Right, so folks are buying it. You're not asking farmers to donate it. This is a commercial business proposition.
Absolutely. I mean, our partners in founding this network, Aaliyah Frazier, who a Black Dirt Farm on Maryland's Eastern Shore, in fact, helps to... She grows the food, her and her partner, Blaine, and they pipe the food into Baltimore. And yes, you pay the farmer. I mean, I think a part of what we're sensitive to is how the charity model has not gotten us as far as we'd like to go. And so to be more sustainable, we have to support farmers. We got to pay farmers. And the same money that people use to buy other stuff that might not be as healthy, you can pay a farmer and get twice as much and have good food for you as well and your family.
Are most of the farmers in the network also people of color?
Absolutely, yeah. We really focus on Black farmers because of the historical ways in which they've been kind of marginalized and how their presence and their role in the Black community really has been forgotten. We have, young people today think chickens grow in giants or grow in corporate, stores. And so it really is as much as a food thing, it's really also a cultural and historical thing, kind of reconnecting you with the people who grow your food, those relationships being in place. And it's really exciting seeing how those connections are being restored.
So the food then is available to folks at church. Mm-hmm. Are there also efforts to get the food from these Black farmers into the Giants and the Safeways and the ShopRites?
Absolutely. I mean, we have some very... We have farmers who are just on the ball, and they're doing so much. So in addition to Aaliyah Frazier and Blaine, other food growers and farmers are coming and joining the network as well, and we're going to have an explosion of them this season as well. But they're on the ball with pipelining their food into restaurants and farmers markets and the like. What we try to do with the Black Church Food Security Network is assist them in every way we can, at the same time giving them a built-in market in terms of the Black Church.
I know I certainly don't eat the way I ate when I was growing up. You know, I grew up in the era of TV dinners and all that kind of stuff. My mom's a good cook. God bless you, Mom. I know she's listening. But, but, you know, we all sort of change and evolve in our approaches to, you know, how we feed ourselves. Is educating and helping folks experiment with new ways of cooking and new ways of feeding their families also part of this deal?
Absolutely, yeah. We personally as well, I'm getting an education on how to cook some of this food, and we found that to be an issue we had to address very early on. Like, how, give me some recipes. You can't just give me food. Give me a recipe. Give me some ideas. Do some food tastings. And so we're going to see even more of that this year, where we're going to ask and have our churches open up their kitchens, as I did mine, Pleasant Hope. A few months back, we had a culinary team come in and cook some food that was familiar enough to the mind, you know. And so, you know, sometimes I think when we do these food tastings, it's just so different that, you know, it's really not appealing or attractive to some folks. And I have a picky palate, so I'm you know, I'm talking about myself now. But, you know, if you can, you know, take a comfort food or down-home favorite and just do it a different way that is familiar enough for me to try it, then I'm going to try it. And so we see that as well.
You getting much resistance to that? You getting enthusiasm? I mean, what's been the reaction? Because it is tough having folks change something as basic as what you eat.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, I mean, it's, all of us, you know, change is just tough for all of us in general.
Yeah.
You know, as a human, as the human race. But how we eat is just such a, you know, a visceral part of how we live.
That's so true. Because it's such an intimate part of our existence. Like, we have stories around the food that we eat. There are certain meals that you would eat, Tom, or I would eat, that take you back to your grandmother, or you know what I mean? So it's not just food, it's all the memories and stuff that comes with it. And so, yes, it can be difficult, but we can make more, we can make new memories, we can add new stories to the long held food memories and stories we have.
There is an organization, or I guess it's a consortium or something, called the Baltimore Food and Faith Project, out of Hopkins, and their Center for a Livable Future. So, is the Black Food Security Network part of that overarching thing?
Yeah, interestingly enough, I was one of the advisory board members of the Baltimore Food and Faith at the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future. And so much of what we're doing, I learned a lot from them, and the relationships and resources and networking continues to be a great help to me now. In fact, Dariel Harris, who works for Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, is also one of the co-founders of the network. And so you got a preacher, a farmer, and, you know, this expert, institutional expert and resource. We all working together, putting together the little pieces that we know and combining our powers to move this network forward.
Sounds like the beginning of a funny joke.
It's exciting.
The preacher,
right,
the farmer, and the researcher walk into a bar, and what happens? You know,
right,
they end
exactly
up with a food security network.
There you go.
Because food security, and you have, I mean, your life as a preacher is a life you really started after your life as an activist. I mean, the as I understand, I mean, do I have the order of that pretty much right? I mean, you've been, or you've been at least concurrently.
Absolutely.
Been
absolutely.
You've been involved in social justice issues, and food security is a basic component of social justice.
Absolutely. And you know what, Tom, it took me a little bit to kind of get to that realization. At first, you know, like many others in Baltimore, I would think about access to healthy food simply as an issue of nutrition, right? And that's super important, absolutely. But as I kept on working and studying and hearing from people like Aaliyah and so many others who've been doing this work for a long time, I began to see the ways in which it's not just a matter of nutrition. It also has to be a matter of justice, planning, policy, institutional racism. Like, how do you get to neighborhoods where they have a saturation of liquor stores but don't have grocery stores? I mean, those type of questions haunt you after a while, and you say, you know what, there's a bigger picture to this than just nutrition.
Yeah, because your church is actually not in what we would call a food desert.
Absolutely.
I mean, you're on Belvedere Avenue, right off York Road, right across the street, basically, from the Belvedere Square.
Absolutely.
Which has plenty of food. But it's pricey, you know, and so, and getting grocery stores into our city is a huge challenge. There are, I think the latest count is about 45. I know I've talked to developers off the record who have said that attracting grocery stores to new developments, new shopping malls or shopping strips, you know, is really hard. The margins in the grocery store business are very short. They're very small. Sometimes, you know, they're selling cans of soup and frozen vegetables and making cents, you know, rather than dollars on each of those sales. it's just really difficult to get a grocer to make a commitment to the city. What could the city be doing, in your view, having studied this and worked in this field for all this time, you know, to get more folks to open grocery stores?
Yeah, I think really, and the complexity you spoke to very well in terms of just all the layers of how to even get at this issue, for at least from a corporate standpoint and development issue standpoint. I think the city, and I've seen some steps, but I think the city could redouble its efforts to really support local growers. And I've read articles recently and done some reading on regional food hubs as well. Like, what would it mean to shorten the distance between the growing of the food and the table that the food is going to be served on? What would it mean to support local farmers and local urban growers? What hurdles, rather, and what red tape can we remove to make it easier for local growers and farmers to do what they do, and us to take advantage of that? And so if your food is coming from, for instance, for us, for the network, if our food is coming from Eastern Shore, there's some things we just don't have to think about that Giants and, you know, other larger grocers have to think about. We don't have to think about it because we have that flexibility, and we're nimble enough as a network to move the food where it needs to be, get it there quickly, and directly pay the farmer. And so there's a whole lot of middle stuff that's cut out. And then also, anchoring this in the Black church, because some have asked, why do you call it the Black Church Food Security Network? Well, the longest standing institution, the most enduring and sustainable institution in Black America is the Black church. It has the longest history. It owns the most land. It has the greatest amount of resources. And it has organized people who come together every week, put their money in a basket, celebrate each other's lives, highs and lows and all that. So that's from my vantage point as a pastor. I said, man, we got so much. What more can we do? And so really birthing this thing through the Black church is important because it helps to protect it from the turbulence that can come from trying to jump out there in a corporate sense, because this institution that's been here is going to be here.
Mm-hmm. Now, the mayor, we should say, you know, has talked about plans to offer tax incentives to grocery chains to, you know, mm-hmm. place stores in the city limits, et cetera. And it's something that every mayor in the last, you know, right. 40 mayors have worried about getting grocery stores. Right. Does the city or the state or the federal government support this, your organization, in any way, or is this completely done, you know, by yourselves?
Right. Yeah, it's done by ourselves. We've had conversations with people, for example, in Baltimore City's. We spoke to Baltimore City's food czar and her mm-hmm. team, and she's mm-hmm. doing Holly, and she's doing
Holly Freyshock.
Uh-huh, mm-hmm. Yeah, and she's offered some great support and resources. But this is largely, you know, we're muscling it through, we're hustling and making it work, and we have about 5 to 7 churches that are going to join the network this coming growing season. We're really excited about that. Some of them have land and are ready to start gardens. Others of them don't have land to grow food, but they have space to set up pop-up farm stands in their sanctuary. So yeah. It's going to grow and be supported by the churches as well.
Well, we'll have you back to keep us up to date on what's going on with that and some of the many other projects that you're involved in. Okay, appreciate your time. Thanks
so much, Tom.
The Reverend Dr. Heber Brown, he's the senior pastor at Pleasant Hope Baptist Church in North Baltimore, the founder of the Black Church Food Security Network. We've got links, WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up after a break for the news, the complexities of siblings as adults. Stay with us. Here's Mr. Sterner.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WIPR in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WIPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WIPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
Thank you, Nathan. We are family, indeed. It's nice. Welcome to the Maryland Morning Wedding Show, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Tom Hall on 88.1. You know, as the cliche goes, we can choose our friends, but we can't choose our families. Whatever the status of our relationships with our parents and or our children may be, most of the time it's our relationships with our siblings that are, at the very least, the longest relationships in our lives. The bond between brothers and sisters is unique, and it's those bonds that my guests this morning have explored in a new book about how those bonds are strengthened or frayed as we get older. Jeffrey Greif and Michael Woolley are on the faculty of the University of Maryland School of Social Work. Their book is called Adult Sibling Relationships, and they join me in the studio. Good morning, guys.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
So, Jeff, the three sort of pillars that you talk about when you study this issue of adult sibling relationships are ambivalence, ambiguity, and affection. Tell us what those are.
Yeah, we were hoping to be able to classify these into nice easy boxes and found out that once we got into the research, which was interviews based on more than 262 siblings talking about 704 relationships, we were left with much more of a gray picture. The affection, of course, is there in most of the relationships to some degree. But we also found that people often have a great deal of ambivalence. They have mixed feelings about how they want their siblings to do about the ups and downs of their 40 to 50 to 60 year career with their siblings. We had a sample of people 40 to 90. And the ambiguity is about sometimes we just don't understand why a brother or sister did what they did, or we feel they don't really understand us.
Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily what they did when we were 5 years old, but it's like what they did a month ago.
Yes, there can be ongoing events that sometimes shock a sibling, may say, I don't know where that came from and I don't know what to do with it. But there's such affection there and there's such a Norman Rockwell-esque view that we should be getting along that when we don't, we begin to feel kind of funny about it. And we, Michael and I, want to try and normalize the fact that it's okay to have ambivalent feelings about a sibling. They're often mixed in with the affection.
Sure. And Michael, there are folks who would describe their sibling, their brother or their sister, as their best friend.
Mm-hmm.
But the dynamics between family members, between siblings, really are different substantially than the dynamics between people who are best friends from grammar school or high school or college or something.
Sure. As you started out talking about, we choose our friends, we choose our spouses, we can unchoose a spouse. A sibling is a relationship for our entire lives. Sometimes they were there when we were born. Sometimes they show up when we're little. But those relationships last our whole lifetime, whether they're good or bad. And to give you an example from our data, as Jeff was talking about, 8% of our respondents said they were never close with their siblings. Only 8%. So,
And by never, do you think that meant like even when they were little kids?
It does mm-hmm. seem to mean that.
Mm-hmm.
So we see that in lots of other questions and lots of other data. About 1 in 10 have very problematic relationships with their siblings. On the other end of the spectrum, 22% said they were always close. So that leaves 70% of us in the middle who are close sometimes, not close at other times. We may have gotten along as kids and now our lifestyles have changed. Our political views have changed, the way we see the world or behave has changed, our hobbies have changed, and we grow apart. But to give you a couple more numbers, about 80% say our sibling relationships are very important, but only about 2/3 of us say that we're close friends with our siblings. So that, I mean, you can see the ambivalence and the affection at the same time.
Michael Woolley, he's here in the studio with Jeffrey Greif. Their new book is called Adult Sibling Relationships on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. So, Jeff, let's talk about a few of the things that, the dimensions, the parameters that affect relationships with our siblings. First is birth order. It's different being a big brother or a big sister as opposed to the little brother or the little sister. And it's different being number 5 of 10 or number 2 of 3.
Yeah, those are very hard to parse out, though, from a research perspective, because you might have a brother who's first and then followed by a number of sisters. And if you have a father or mother that holds a closer tie to a son or daughter, that can affect the balance. Other researchers have said that birth order really does matter. It's very hard to parse that out based on the age gap between the oldest child and the next child, the gender, the number of siblings, and where the parent is in his or her own development, because that will affect the attachment that the oldest has to a mother or father.
Mm-hmm.
So very hard to parse these out and say that, yes, older kids do better or younger children get less attention. It can vary greatly by gender.
And you also found that gender, it does impact things greatly, but also the fact of whether or not the siblings themselves are parents. In other words, if a brother is also the father of 2 or 3 kids or whatever, that's going to affect his relationship with his own siblings.
These are extremely...
That's fascinating.
It is. And these are extremely complicated relationships. Jeff and I talk a lot about the fact that much psychological research has looked at families vertically, parent to child, And what siblings do is we're looking horizontally. But the fact is, the horizontal and the vertical interact. As you said, when fathers get along with their siblings, the father's children are much more likely to get along with their siblings. So we hypothesize that fathers role model these positive sibling relationships. We also found other parenting issues that are important. When parents play favorites among siblings, when they interfere in sibling relationships, those sibling relationships are more likely to be problematic in childhood, and those problems tend to continue into adulthood.
Yeah, I want to talk about that, the famous Smothers Brothers line. Of, right. You know, mom always liked you best. You know, I can't remember whether it was Tommy or Dickie that complained about that. But first of all, that does happen. There
that
are parents
happen.
Who pick favorites.
Absolutely.
Right? And when it does happen, what can be the consequences of that?
Well, sometimes, of course, happens on a conscious level. Sometimes it's an unconscious level. I know of parents who were middle children themselves who favored their own middle child. And I don't think they did that consciously. I think they felt trapped as a middle child, so they naturally tried to untrap their own middle child. So that can cause reverberations through the next generation, and then those siblings have children, and they're not as close. And this can sort of play out in a number of ranges across generations. And we're hoping to help people to understand that if they can figure out a way to be close with their own siblings, it's going to help them and their next generations to have closeness between their children, between the children that they have that are siblings, which will hopefully redound to better care for them as they age.
Mm-hmm. And Mike Willie, speaking of generations, there is a generational difference in the quality and the should we say, the positiveness of relationships between siblings. If you're a Depression-era child, mm-hmm. if you're a baby, you tend to be closer to your siblings mm-hmm. than people born more recently.
Yeah, we did. We found several different generational differences, and we found generational differences by gender as well, that in older generations, sisters are more open, more communicative, more supportive of their siblings, but that seems to be changing in the younger segment of our sample. The 40-year-olds and the early 50-year-olds are more likely to communicate about difficult issues such as money and family and sex, whereas the older siblings were not. But they did tend to be closer in other ways.
Jeff Greif, you talk about how cutoffs occur. Mm-hmm. People just become cut off from their family. Sometimes if they're one of four or five children, they're cut off from three of their sibs and maybe close to one or sometimes close to none. And that these cutoffs are often precipitated by traumatic events, a death in the family, maybe a death of a parent. Was there any, were there recurring things that happened common to a lot of different people in that regard?
Sometimes the cutoffs are based on what has been handed down from generation to generation, and those cutoffs may occur in families that have had other cutoffs in other generations. So there is this link between family history and cutoffs in some cases. But we also know of cutoffs that have occurred because of untoward events. Siblings were shocked by someone else's behavior who was their sibling, and they had no idea this was going to be happening. Something occurs, there's a battle over the estate. Somebody sleeps with somebody else who they shouldn't be sleeping with. Things are said. A parent dies and things become uncovered that have been covered over that are really a shock to the siblings. And that ends relationships that have been sort of traveling along in a pretty good path.
Yeah. You also report, and this was fascinating to me, that 40%, this seems like a lot of folks, 40% of adults have at least one step relative in their family. Mm-hmm. So Mike Willie, I mean, the step relatives bring a whole new dimension to this, doesn't it?
They do. And it's interesting, when Jeff and I first started our conversations about doing this book, and it was Jeff had the idea about the book and came to me and talked to me. And one of the things we discovered, even though we had worked together a couple of years and played music together, we had very, very different sibling experiences in our own families. Jeff can tell you about his, but he's one of three, and they all got along really well. I'm one of six, and I have one of those complicated family genograms with multiple marriages, and I have half siblings, and those relationships are different, and our data bears that out. There are exceptions. There are half siblings and step siblings that are very, very close, but for the most part, the full siblings tend to be closer, and they tend to continued to interact well into their adulthood.
One of the things that I was happy to find in your reporting, Jeff, is that the data is showing that actually we're less jealous of our siblings as adults. That perhaps
sure.
if we had jealousy when we were younger, at a different stage in our lives, that tends to mellow out a little bit as we get older.
Yeah, we find that as we mature, we identify ourselves and find self-identity outside of the family more and more, and with our family of orientation, not our family of origin. So a family of orientation is who you're choosing to consider your family. Family of origin is what you're stuck with. And as we redefine ourselves as adults, we find that we don't compete as much with our siblings as we used to. We don't need our parents to define us. Maybe our significant other, our spouse, can help to define us.
But the competition, if there is competition when you're younger, the competition never completely goes away, does it?
In many families, it does not. In some families, it does.
Yeah. Spoken like a researcher. So, Mike Woolley, one of the things that was interesting to me is that this whole topic area is relatively new. I mean, sibling studies of siblings is only about 10 years old or something. Right? So you guys are starting stuff off new.
It's actually kind of baffling when we first started looking in the literature. You talked about sibling order. That research is probably the longest lasting research about siblings. But it's mostly focused on childhood. There's been very little research about adult sibling relationships, and we reviewed the work that was done, but we were amazed at how little had been done and how influential these relationships can be. These are the folks we live with when we're little, and these are the folks we kind of hope will help take care of us when we become old. It behooves us in an aging society to focus on these relationships and help make these relationships strong and long-lasting. And unfortunately, the psychotherapy field has virtually ignored these relationships.
And Jeff, you talked about how the number of interviews you did for this research, but still the research is a little hard to do because our recollections of being little kids are fundamentally foggy, aren't they?
Yes, and we did not interview a lot of sibling sets. We interviewed mostly individuals because that's who tends to show up for therapy. And there's no truth in a family. I have my perspective. My siblings with whom I'm close have theirs, but they grew up with me and I grew up with them. So we're really in different families to some extent.
Yeah, well, it's fascinating stuff, and I appreciate both of you guys coming in and talking about it.
Thanks, Tom.
Jeffrey Greif and Michael Woolley, their new book is called Adult Sibling Relationships. They'll be talking about it Saturday morning at 11 o'clock at the Roland Park branch of the Enoch Pratt Library. And we've got details on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. On 88.1, it is Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more ahead. Stay with us. If you've been on Calvert Street in Mount Vernon here in Baltimore recently, you've noticed that Center Stage is currently a construction site. But as Shakespeare writes in As You Like It, all the world's a stage, and for the time being, Center Stage has moved its world to the Center for the Arts at Towson University. Our worldly theater critic, Jay Wynn Russick, has been to see As You Like It. She brings us this review.
As You Like It is one of Shakespeare's romantic comedies in which a woman outsmarts a man, in part by disguising herself as a man. Shakespeare wrote some great women's roles, including this one, Rosalind. But women make up less than 20% of Shakespeare's almost 1,000 characters, probably because female performers were banned from the stage and their roles were played by boys. In Center Stage's current production, director Wendy C. Goldberg, a new play specialist, does her bit to even the score by using an all-female cast. This is nothing new. There are women-only Shakespeare companies, and locally, the Baltimore Shakespeare Factory did an all-female Henry IV during last summer's Parody Fest. But central as this casting may be to director Goldberg's concept, her production's hip style makes the strongest impression. She starts things off with the cast doing regimented emo choreography to electronic dance music. Costume designer Ann Kennedy dresses the actors in high-fashion black. Their expressions are fierce. This is life at court. Severe, controlled, a little scary. Here, brothers hate brothers. The ruling duke has seized power from and banished his brother. He then banishes his niece, Rosalind, and his daughter chooses to go with her. For safety's sake, Rosalind dresses as a man, and they head for the forest. The forest also turns out to be a haven for Rosalind's banished father and for her love interest, Orlando, who's on the run from his own hateful brother. The country proves far more carefree than the court. Rosalind's father and his followers live and dress like hippies. Angela Reed plays melancholy Jaques as a stoner in dreadlocks. And accompanied on a boombox, the crew sings folksy renditions of Shakespeare's songs, composed by Matt Hubbs. Forget you're watching women playing men, but that amplifies Shakespeare's theme of the mutable nature of gender. Consider the famous scene in which Rosalind, pretending to be a man, promises to cure lovesick Orlando. The cure causes them both to fall deeper in love. This production adds another layer to the script's joke about gender confusion.
Now I will be your Rosalind in a more coming-on disposition, and ask me what you will, I will grant it.
Then love me, Rosalind.
Julia Coffey's Rosalind is resolute and independent. Sophia Jean Gomez's Orlando starts out bitter, but becomes irrepressibly joyful in love. They're the romantic model for the play's three other amorous couples. But those couples are way overpowered by Rosalind and Orlando in this version, adapted by Gavin Witt. His adaptation tightens the script and reorders some of the scenes. The court scenes, for example, are now grouped together at the beginning. Court is inhospitable, and once we leave, we never have to go back. Set designer Arnolfo Maldonado uses a rigid wooden structure for the scenes at court. In the country, the structure is replaced by a birch tree forest, tents, and lawn chairs. Just as the play moves from court to country, center stage has, temporarily, moved from city to county. While its Calvert Street building is being renovated, the theater is in residence at Towson University, and a half-dozen students ably play ensemble roles. Center Stage's feminist take honors the original tradition of single-sex casting and subverts it at the same time. Does this girls' night out succeed? Like Rosalind herself, it's smart, funny, and challenges gender stereotypes. It's a likable As You Like It. And stylistically, it's a beaut.
As You Like It is at Center Stage's temporary home in the Center for the Arts at Towson University. It's there until Valentine's Day. We've got details about tickets and showtimes on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins us most Monday mornings here on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up after a break for the news, Dr. Skip Saunders joins us to talk about the past and future of the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. Stay with us.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan. Good morning again, and welcome back. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. Dr. Skip Saunders took over the helm of the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture 4 years ago. He retired from that position last week, and this morning he joins me in Studio A to talk about what lies ahead for this unique and important institution. Skip Saunders, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's good to be here.
Always a pleasure to see you.
I'm always used to hosting you in the museum.
That's right. I usually come over to you. Now you've come to us, and we appreciate it. And we very much appreciate your spending your first day of retirement hanging around on Maryland Morning, and I'm delighted. Your last official day at the museum was just last Friday.
I couldn't think of a better person to be with.
Well, so. I'm flattered, and I appreciate it. And it will get you everywhere, by the way. Flattered. Now, you took over the Lewis about 4 years ago, and the museum at that time was in a fairly precarious position. I mean, there were some financial problems. You had some harsh language in some of the legislative audits, but you've been able to turn it around in these 4 years.
Well, I'd like to say 180, but I can't say that. What I've learned is museums will always be in a somewhat precarious position until they get to be old and known, like MoMA or, you know, some of our really great local ones that have been around a century. But I think that we've succeeded.
And we should say, by the way, this is the 10th anniversary year for the Lewis Museum.
10th year, that's right. Yeah. So that is a great milestone for us. But I think what we've done together as a team has been to really establish a vision for the museum and a real strong sense of direction. And then the staff really has proven to the city and itself that it is creative, energetic, and quite active. We had a year this year, just think of all the programs, Tom, that we, for the 10th anniversary. And then, I mean, if you want to think about some culminating points, we had three. I said, if you asked me what were my favorite, I'd have to talk about Misty Copeland, but I'd have to talk about our great gala, but I'd have to talk about, you know, yeah. So, yeah.
But these are events that have been happening at the Lewis. Of course, this coming Saturday, you've got the Morgan Choir singing, and it helped kick off the Black History Month.
Black History Month, and it also ties right into the Ruth Starr Rose exhibit that we have, because so much of that was about the life of Eastern Shore African American Marylanders, and also
right.
the spirituals and all of that. So that's a great tie.
It seems to me, from my vantage point, that one of the things that has definitely changed over the last few years since you've been there is that the Lewis Museum as a location, as a destination for things other than just the exhibitions. Misty Copeland's a perfect example. She's the prima ballerina of the New York City Ballet, first African-American dancer to be elevated to that position. I mean, she's, you know, become an international celebrity. When she came to town, she chose to speak at the Lewis,
yes.
not someplace else.
Yes. And that was wonderful for us. I'll never forget, I was talking to one of the people, Arnold Williams, who was one of our auditors, and he said, my wife and I were driving down President Street. We saw this line all the way around the museum. We got on the phone. We said, something's going on at the museum. There's a line all the way around. And I went, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Good to see lines. Lines are good things
lines
in the museum
are good
world.
Things, yes.
What do you think the impact of the new National Museum of African American History is going to be on the Lewis Museum here in Baltimore? That National Museum scheduled to open later this year in Washington.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. You know, I think the old Chinese saying about the crisis also is an opportunity. It depends on how you position yourself and how you look at it. Luckily, this museum has always said its focus was Maryland African American history and culture, and really digging deep into the Maryland roots, which supply so many of the great heroes, I mean, that we know of, Marshall and, you know, Tubman, all of them, Frederick Douglass. So if we continue, I think, to really focus that way, we will always fulfill the key mission, which was to really be a point of unity and learning for Marylanders first, all the Maryland communities. And I think the National Museum, of course, is going to be showing things on the full magnitude national scope. So if we don't try to compete with that, but really tell our story, I think people will be interested. And if we can form an alliance with Lonnie Bunch and just, you know, make sure that he and the Smithsonian have a way of telling people, check out this regional museum that's the second largest regional museum in the country, and really get into the Maryland story more deeply. I think that'll work out well.
You got a new curator there, a gentleman named Charles Bethea, and it appears that he's taking a new curatorial direction. For example, he has declared this year, 2016, is the year of the black male. You've got exhibitions that are, one of them is currently up there by Devin Allen, a photographer whose photograph ended up on the cover of Time magazine after the unrest in April. Does that represent a striking departure from what you have been doing over these last 4 years? Is that what we can expect moving forward?
I think what it really represents is an additional kind of perspective that we had. When we were working on a strategic plan, we realized that we could be better at showing how relevant history was to the present. And of course, with the unrest that occurred in our wonderful city, that just drove that point home to us, that if you're going to be an African American museum, you've got to speak to the issues that keep bubbling up and boiling up in our society and keep us from being the one people that we say we all want to be. And so when we focused on relevance, all of those things just started to come about. Devin Allen being there, those photographs, third amateur photographer ever to have his photograph taken for a cover for Time magazine, 26 years old, his passion for working with the community, his love for his city. So that really cemented our belief that we could take that first floor space and actually make an additional gallery out of it, combined with the museum shop, and allow people to come in there for free and really look at topics and issues that are hitting current and have a current impact, but then begin through our programming to show the tie between that and what was upstairs in the permanent exhibition galleries and the temporary gallery. And it's worked out beautifully. So when Charles came, I mean, he sort of lit up because that's the direction he wanted to go in. He wanted to show that museums need to be relevant and need to speak to the present for the past and vice versa. And that's so when, and the other thing that happened, and all of this in a sense was just providential. I don't want to say coincidental, providential, because Calvin Butler approached us right after the gala.
He's the CEO of
BGE, and he wanted to do this special program called Men of Courage, which really focuses on the plight of African-American males. We kicked off the year, the new year, right in January with that Men of Courage program by sponsored by him and the Ford Fund. And then that led right away to Charles's declaration, this is going to be the year of the African-American male.
Mm-hmm. Are there challenges that the Lewis Museum faces? And as we finish up, we only got mm-hmm. about 30 seconds. Are they challenges that are unique to the Lewis because it concentrates on African-American history? Or are they basically the same as the challenges that you know the BMA faces in the Walters and the other large museums in town?
I think both of your statements are true. Older museums, which have established themselves, make it. But a young museum, 10 years old, is always going to be financially challenged until it's well established and has philanthropy coming to mm-hmm. it, really.
Yeah, and 10 years, it's a good milestone, but it's still, you're not a teenager yet.
It's still in diapers.
Yeah, okay. There you go. Well, Skip Sanders, best of luck to you. You've done a great job at the Lewis, and we look forward to hearing other great things as you move to the next step.
Thank you, Tom, and thanks for being such a great friend of the museum.
Well, it's our pleasure to be so. Dr. Skip Sanders, he is now the former director of the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture. The current special exhibition at the Lewis is a collection of paintings by Ruth Starr Rose. It's called Revelations of African American Life in Maryland and the World. It'll be there until April. You've got about 6 more weeks to see the exhibition of photographs by Devin Allen. That's called Awakenings in a New Light. That's a collection of photographs of the riots and uprising last April. Lots of stuff going on for Black History Month at the Lewis. For example, as we mentioned, the Morgan State Choir will be giving a concert there at 3 o'clock Saturday afternoon. We've got all the details on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. That'll do it for us today. Coming up Wednesday, we continue our conversations with candidates for mayor of Baltimore. David Warnock will join me to share his thoughts for the future of our city. And I'll speak to the former pop music critic of the Baltimore Sun, Rashad Olison, about his new memoir. Until then, for Nathan Sterner and the entire Maryland Morning team, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day.